And we hope that it is by disclosing ourselves and our problems that they will be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Again, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. And, you know, this meeting is so great, and we have so many wonderful people that work here. Tim is, you know, doing a lot now. Leslie done such a great job for a long time. And I love coming here. It's been great to see how it's grown. But I'll tell you a little secret. What little time I have in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned it's not that hard to get people to chair meetings, and it's not that hard to get people to speak, but it's hard to get people to do service work that doesn't show up anywhere. And there is nobody that does more service work at the NABA Clubhouse than our speaker tonight. I had no idea until I got involved in the board and trying to work a little bit just how much Frank does here. And if we had to pay anybody to do what Frank does, we couldn't afford it. We could not afford it. There are very few days go by he's not up here for an hour or two doing something. And I want to take this opportunity to tell him I appreciate that. And, I mean, I'll get up 3 or 4 calls a week. We got so-and-so going on. So I'll get somebody down. No, I've already fixed it. You know, just want to let you know. But I love him. And he is more than anybody at NAB, I think. He has shown me what it's like. And he's been doing this many, 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 many years. Try to find somebody that will consistently do anything for 1 year and be faithful to it, and that's tough, but this is many, many years. And a lot of the things we benefit from at NABA because of our speaker tonight, not only that, he's a great guy, he encourages everybody, and I'm proud to introduce my friend, Frank. So.
Everybody, I'm Frank Waters, and I'm a real alcoholic. And they say we tell our stories in a general way, and that's how I'm going to try to tell mine tonight. So if you came here to hear a bunch of, trash on Frank or ammunition, then, you need to talk to one of my old sponsors. It took Tim a while to get me up here. He said, I'll do it for me. It's my birthday. His birthday is tomorrow. And I said, okay. I didn't have the heart to tell him I didn't plan on getting him anything for his birthday anyway. I've got my sobriety date's 10/31/89. I've got 18 years, 8 months, 8 and a half months of sobriety. Not to impress anybody, just let you know I do have one. I've heard some speakers, I couldn't tell if they were sober or not, or had a sobriety date. This is only like my 10th or 12th time, 15th time telling my story. And I go through a little anxiety about it because I feel like, I've already shared it enough. People know enough about me. And there's a lot of new people in the room that don't know anything about me or might have the same story I do. And so my second sponsor's wife said she went to meetings for 12 years for sure. Anybody that shared had the same story she did. So she thought she was all alone for a long time. I was born and raised in Atlanta. And for those of you that are confused about that, that means inside the city limits. All I ever hear is, nobody's from Atlanta. It's hard. It's like when I grew up, the city was full of people. But my family's from Atlanta, except on my mother's side. They're from Decatur and Avondale. I come from a long, distinguished line of alcoholics. Most of those aren't with us because they're alcoholics. Like I said, I've got over 18 years. My father's got over 30 years. He got sober in 75. I started drinking, when I was 5 years old. I used to carry beer from the kitchen to my dad in the living room. And back then, you had to have a can opener to open the beer can. So they'd open it, my mother would open it in the kitchen, and I'd sip on it all the way to the living room. And I got to do this until I would stagger too much, and they wouldn't let me carry any more beer to my dad. And I come from a divorced family. And when I was 14, I went to live with my father. And at 14, I started drinking. You know, because when I was 14, back then you had a lot of package stores. You had, you know, a package store everywhere, and they had drive-through windows. And I was a big kid, and nobody questioned me for an ID or anything. So all my buddies would get me to go in there and buy the beer. And I was a blackout drinker from the start. You know, I don't know when to quit or why I'd want to. And that went on, you know, for a while. And my father got separated from his second wife. And I went to South Georgia to live with my grandmother and great-grandmother. And it was harder to come by down there. Of course, there were other things you could get into down there. And moonshine was available. And I was a city kid, so, you know, I stood out from everybody else anyway. Everybody else had grown up knowing each other all their lives. And it was in a town with a population of about 1,000. So everybody knew who I was, who I belonged to, and what I was doing. And my father would get reports about, you know, my behavior. And it wasn't long before my father moved back up to the house he had moved out of. And he was drinking rather heavily. And he'd come down to visit every now and then. And he came down one time and he had a spiritual experience. He had quit drinking. Went to AA. And I moved back up there with him. And I was 16 then. And my father went to Rebo's. And back then it was just a little bitty house with a bunch of, you know, it's a house that gutted and put a bunch of poles everywhere to support the roof, and the floors all did like this, and you'd have to be sober to walk through that place. You know, you couldn't do it drunk. And AAs back then were a lot different than they are now. They were just mean people. And they were just mean people. You know, when they said tough love, that meant that they were just about to kick you out the door. You know, they didn't take any of this stuff we accept today and like, oh, just let them be, let them take part in their own recovery. They'll get there. They weren't like that. But they didn't allow anybody to go to their meetings but them. And they allowed me to sit in the meetings and answer the phone because they hated when the phone rang in the meeting and the phone was up by the front door of the house. So they'd let me sit up there and answer the phone. And they would let me go over to Bronner's and pick up drunks and bring them to meetings. I think a lot of that had to do with how lazy they were. They just glad to have somebody else drive out there and get them and answer the phone. But they made me go to Alateen meetings. And so I was spending too much time around other alcoholics. Around alcoholics. I wasn't an alcoholic then. And so I went on for a while, and I got 17 and went back down to live with my grandmother's, and I joined the Marine Corps. And I had to get my father to sign for me to go in. And he did that, and I got lynched with my grandmother's, but it was just done. And so I went into Marine Corps in 75. And I've always been hard-headed. I've just always been real stubborn. And I had my own sense of what was right and wrong. And the Marine Corps fine-tuned some of those things. And I learned different things. I learned new ways to drink. And it all basically got you know, down your throat, but I learned new ways to drink. And raise hell, not get in trouble, or get in trouble. But my father said the Marine Corps calmed me down a lot. I never have gotten clear about what he means by that, but he sticks to his story that, you know, I'm a lot calmer and more pleasant to be around after I got went into the Marines. And, you know, the Marines taught me a lot of things, a lot of discipline, how to accept things you don't really want to accept or don't understand, how to defend myself and how to take lives. And That's pretty much the gist of that. I mean, that's what they're geared to do. And I thought I knew what I was doing when I got out of the service. But, you know, now I've been retired for the last, 10 years, if I'd have stayed in, which I kind of miss, but I knew too much. I was in there with a lot of Vietnam veterans and a lot of people that just, said, screw the system. And that was hard to get out of me, but I came out of the Marines in 1979. I rotated back from Okinawa. And for a long time, I was never a dope addict. My metabolism is such that most drugs either don't affect me or they have the opposite effect of what they're supposed to have. And I had plenty of buddies trying to get me stoned or high on, a lot of different things. And it took them almost 3 years before I ever got high off pot. And it would take a lot of that sort of thing to get me high even after I got high. But when I came out of the service, I was, cut free. I was out of prison. I was just gone. Sleeping in my truck. I'd show up at my father's house one day or even stay for a couple of days, where I'd just take off and show up at my grandmother's house 200 miles away. Nobody knew where I was at or how to get a hold of me. And I was just doing my thing. And I had a girlfriend that was accepting of that. I mean, she didn't welcome it with open arms, as the definition says, but she tolerated it. And I wasn't getting married until I was 25. And a lot of us, I got a lot of drunk-a-log stories where, I'd wake up and there'd be a motorcycle in the back of my truck. And I didn't own a motorcycle. But I'd have one. I'd go out to my car, my truck in the mornings, and there'd be, one time there was blood all over the front seat. And I wasn't scratched anywhere. I did a lot of things that that might sound good to a 12-year-old. But looking back on it, I'm just surprised. I'm not in prison now. Or dead. I got married when I was 25. I said I wouldn't get married until I was 25. And so this woman waited till I was 25. I turned 25 in June. And we got married in July. And time rolled along, and we had a son, and I named him after my grandfather and great-grandfather. And then as time went, as alcoholic marriages go, we separated and got back together and had another baby. Now, this first boy, Carl, he was a daddy's boy from the get-go. He was built like me. He was, had a real big chest. And my other son was small and slender like the rest of my family. They built like basketball players or swimmers or something. And he was just a mama's boy. It just didn't matter what I did. He was mama's boy, and Carlton was a daddy's boy. And wound up getting evicted out of a duplex over here by Oglethorpe. And there wasn't anything we did. They were trying to renovate the property and try to sell it. So I moved to my mother-in-law, a woman I've learned to tolerate. And she got that part of our code. Love and tolerance is our code, but I learned to tolerate her. I just never have learned to love the woman. If you've ever met her, I'm sure you'd make your own opinion about that. But we were there a few months, and I was working. And I got a phone call that I needed to get to the hospital, that my son had drowned. But he was going to the hospital. So I took him to the hospital. They took him to the hospital, and I got there, and he drowned on August 30th. His birthday was September 18th. They pronounced him dead on September 17th. Day before his third birthday. And I was just shot all to hell. And a lot of times I still am. That's some a lot of things you don't get over, and that's just one of them that I just don't get over. I deal with it pretty good most of the time, and then there's sometimes Carlson just attacks me. He did it just the other day. And I went drinking. My buddies said, "You need to go drinking. We need to get you out drinking." And so this one friend of mine got getting kicked out of the bars because he was too drunk and had let me in. And I got through in the bar, I'd come wake him up, and I'd go driving around. Finally, I took him home. And I'd taken all the guns out of the house, and my wife wouldn't do anything with the guns because she was supposed to be watching my son when he was in the pool. And that was the city of Atlanta picked me up right there by the zoo. They got a little precinct right there. I was one block up. And had a bunch of beer and liquor in the car, all the guns in the car, and I was smoking two joints at one time. I'm thinking that's probably because I couldn't find the one, but they were still burning. But, hell, I don't know. I've been drinking all night. I might have been smoking both of them at one time. But they were both lit when the police pulled me over. And they were hauling my ass off to jail. And Connie, my friend's wife, came down the street and told them what had happened. And they were trying to let me go, but they couldn't figure out a way to let me go because once that call went out over the radio, it was logged in on tape, and they had to do something. So, but they were nice about it. They let Connie have the car with all the weapons in there and stuff, and took me to jail, and I was going to prison. Because up until then, I had an HB probationary license. In case any of y'all know what that is, that's a habitual violator. You have to have, you know, three suspendable offenses to get that. And I had one other DUI and some other stuff. I used to be a truck driver. And so I had quite a few tickets, so I was just on the edge. And what I used to tell people was when they asked for your ID for checks and stuff, because back then you wrote a lot of checks, you didn't have ATM cards that much. I'd say it was for highway volunteer. I was a highway volunteer sanctioned by the Georgia State Patrol. Anybody that, you know, was broke down or needed help, that, you know, I'd help them out, give them a ride somewhere, you know, fit work on the car, give me a little money for that, you know. I'd at wrecks and stuff, I would flag traffic, just whatever they needed me to do. And most cashiers believe that. Because on that license, it was right across the front of it, in big red letters, HV, and so. Anyway, that's the only way I could twist that and make it, you know, comfortable for me to have that on my license and everybody seeing it, not thinking I was some, you know, derelict or something, some drunk. So I was but the judge wasn't, you know, the judge knew I wasn't a highway volunteer. You know, he knew who I was, and I was going to prison. Because once you have an HV probationary license, your next suspendable offense, you go to jail for 5 years. And since my son had died, the lawyers and the judge got together and decided that I would get 2 more years tacked on to my suspension. And I served a day at the courthouse filing tickets, and I got to go home. And, you know, I was scared shitless. You know, they told me to go to lunch down at Underground, and I'm like, okay, where's the guard at that's going to watch me? I said, oh, you just go on down there. And I tell you that because it put an extreme amount of guilt on me for a long time that I had not gone to prison because of my son's death. And I had my son had drowned in my mother-in-law's backyard because I wasn't working enough to buy a house. You know, I had just anything I could add on to it, I could add on to it. You know, as alcoholics, we're big on pyramid thinking. We take, you know, the little thing, and the pyramid goes opposite of what you normally see. It just expands. It just takes off. But before I went to see that judge, my lawyer, who was a friend of my sister-in-law, said, you need to go to AA meetings before we go to court. And I said, for what? I'd seen what AAs are. They're a bunch of It's like a Bible-thumping cult or something, you know. And he goes, no, you need to go to AA meetings. So I went to an AA meeting on a Friday night at the Biscayne Room, at the Night Owls meeting. And I had went to a Saturday night meeting at the Night Owls meeting because, see, I didn't want to lie to the judge and say I've been to AA meetings when I only went to one. And I thought y'all were closed on Sunday. I'd have probably went to that one. So I went to two AA meetings, so it looked good to that judge. And, of course, with that and whatever else they said in that room with the closed doors, I got away with it. Although I didn't have a license for the next two years and 6 months. It was added on to my suspension. My suspension was almost up. And but I went to those meetings, and there was a woman in there named Mary Ellen Kay. And she would not leave me alone. I mean, I walked in that room, and everybody, it was like putting, you know, oil in water. It just went. I sat down on the back couch. Back then they had couches around the back end, and they had some chairs and stuff around the sides and some other couches. It's not like it is today. And it was an old smoky room, and I sat down on that couch, and people got up and moved. They moved over to let me sit down. I mean, they got up off the damn couch and went and sat somewhere else in the room. And it wasn't until that room filled up and there was no other seats that people finally started sitting back on them couches back there where I was sitting. But they left me a space that, you know, my wife today could have sat in. But, you know, there's that much room and people standing up, nobody wanted to sit by me. And Mary Ellen kept talking to me after the meeting. Kept talking, and I would grunt at her, okay. And that's the extent of my conversation as far as, you know, that went. And Saturday came around, went to the meeting, same thing happened. You know, I'd walk up to the front to get coffee, and it was just like, you know, Jesus was parting the water or something. People just got the hell out of my way, got the coffee, went back, sat down. Nobody spoke to me but Mary Ellen. And then I went to court that Monday. And about a week later, I hadn't had anything to drink. And I got to wondering what that little woman was doing. Yeah, it's the first time anybody that looked like some of y'all would talk to me in years that weren't related to me. You know, or didn't just have to, like a cashier or something. Nobody would talk to me. So I went back to a meeting. And they got around to the chip part, and it made it sound good. Something made it sound good. So Terry A. was giving out the chips. And we went to the white chip, this whole spiel, and went to the white chip. And then by the time I got nerve enough to stand up, he said the 30-day chip, people started clapping. And I'm like, no, I don't have 30 days. And somebody said, just go on up there. And I went up to the front of the room and got that chip from Terry. And Terry grabbed me and hugged me. Now, you know, I from where I come from, I mean, until the past 20 years, men didn't hug men unless, you know, it was your father and he was dying or something. And he grabbed me in front of the whole room. And it was a packed room. And I just got stiff as a board. Now, Terry's bigger than me. He's not as tall as I am. He's bigger than me. And he wasn't letting go. And I was, I'm sure, five shades of red when he let me loose. And I just wanted to go crawl in the room somewhere, you know, off the wall room they have on the side. I was like, man. But, you know, it was packed, so you couldn't get in the doorways. And it's like, shit, I had to walk back through everybody knowing that this big guy didn't hug me up here. And it's like, he's got to be gay. I mean, he was, you know, he was smiling, he was happy, had red hair. Just, anyway. I got nothing against, you know, happy people. But at the time, it was a little threat to my psyche there. You know, when I went to get out of the Marine Corps, I had to go through a whole bunch of tests to make sure I was capable of interacting with the civilian population. And Dan, you know, Dan's right. I almost didn't pass those tests. You know, I was almost about to sign up again for the Marine Corps, and I was waiting for him to call me. But I wanted to go to the Air Force. You know, when I got out, so, man, those guys got it made, living in hotels. You know, it's like Jesus. And I'm living in a barracks that reminds you of Gomer Pyle, but worse. You know, old Quonset Huts. Quonset Huts at Mount Fuji, when it's like 10 degrees outside, it's cold in the middle of the buildings, I tell you. Air Force never called. The Army called, the Navy called, the Marine Corps called a bunch of times. I just didn't want to go back. But I kept hearing all this stuff about sponsors. You got to have a sponsor. You got a sponsor. I asked Terry about it once. He says, "Yeah, you need to have a sponsor." And that was it. Walked away from me. And I asked Judy P. about sponsor, because she seemed to be the queen bitch, you know. I mean, she sat down, and the Al-Anons and the AA sat around this woman. It was like a little coven, or a hen's roost or something around her. It's like, she's got something on these people. And she goes, "Yeah, honey, you need a sponsor. Without one, you're not going to stay sober, but it ain't going to matter because you ain't going to be around that long anyway." Okay. You don't know who you're talking to. Now, you got to keep in mind, now, when I started going to Biscayne meetings, and for a long time, you know, I carried like 7 or 8 knives on me. And I had an old blackjack hanging out of my back pocket. I had a .22 automatic in my back pocket, and I had a .32 in my jacket. So not everybody, nobody came and talked to me, but it damn sure didn't hug me or shake my hand. And if you're familiar with people with the chewed skull and they have that round imprint on the back of their blue jeans, or their wallet's stuck out there and you can see that imprint. Well, it took me a while. My first sponsor said, you know, I was bitching one day to him about, you know, how you AAs are so sacrimonious, and I'm saying that right, but sanctimonious, but you know, you don't hug me. You don't shake my hand. You don't say, "Oh, glad to see you. Keep coming back." You know, nobody said that to me, but Mary Ellen. You know, I was beginning to think she was a little out there, you know. And my first sponsor's name was Carl. Carl S. And he said, "Well, son, how can you expect anybody to hug you? You're not huggable." I said, "Why am I not huggable?" He goes, "Well, you walk into the meeting looking like Rambo." I said, you're not the first one to walk in there with carrying a gun. And all those knives you got hanging off of you, and you got some in your boot and all this stuff." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "Well, I'm in a damn whole room full of admitted liars, cheats, and thieves. And alcoholics and drug addicts. And, you know, I was used to those kind of people because that's where I came from. You know, I used to pack beer at the Claremont Lodge, the Claremont Lounge down Ponce de Leon. I'd pack beer, you know, walk dancers out to their cars, throw guys out of the bar, all for free beer. You had to pay me just make sure I didn't get dry. You know, hell yeah, I carry guns to meet." And so Carl disarmed me. And it was just my own need to be, you know, a part of something that he'd make me look in the mirror and talk to myself in the mirror while I was talking to him. It drove me crazy because, you know, you want to look at somebody when you're talking to them. He'd make me stare in that mirror to see what my face looked like when I spoke to people. And he made me quit carrying any firearms I could carry in my pocket. I said, "Well, I still carry this one in my jacket." And he goes, "Well, summer's coming." And eventually, you know, I quit carrying guns to meetings, and I still carry at least one knife to meeting. I just basically clean my fingernails these days, but you know, time rocked along, and I was Carl moved. He was a prison guard, and he had to take off, and so I get a new sponsor. My new sponsor was Craig Pierce. I can tell you it was Craig Pierce because Craig's dead now. And most all of us, See, he's calling Papa. And when Craig left, he made me get a new sponsor. And I didn't want to get a new sponsor. He said, well, come go with me. And he moved to Ohio. And I wasn't sure about going to Ohio with, you know, I got an 18-month-old baby at home and stuff. I was separated from my wife, naturally. I mean, you get drunk, you come into AA, you get separated. That's just the way it works for most people. And but I didn't go. And I got another sponsor. And I didn't work well with this sponsor. He didn't work well with me. Everybody thought that we would be good for each other. But he's still a friend. But Craig moved off. And, you know, a lot of times when I would call Craig at night, I wouldn't get Craig because he'd be out working. And I'd get Judy. And this is the woman, when I first got a year, I introduced Judy to my parents as the person I got sober at. Remember now, Judy was the one that said, it don't matter, you won't be here long anyway. Well, I got sober at that woman. And I introduced her that way, and until it came out of my mouth, it didn't sound bad. And Judy took it like a trooper and said, well, honey, whatever works for you. And my father was more elegant about, you know, smoothing things over, but, you know, I'm just a little rough. And sometimes, I'll stop and I'll search for words, or I'll look at you and I'll be trying to think of something to say because I'm trying not to cuss. You know, and all this thing, you know, he cusses like a sailor. Well, a sailor ain't got nothing on this Marine about cussing. And it almost has transformed my speaking ability into a stutter sometimes because, you know, MF and GD is just a constant thing coming out of my mouth. And that's one thing Carl and Craig worked on. And their sponsor was a woman named Mary Campbell. And they gave me Mary Campbell as a grief sponsor. And I had no idea they were you know, manipulating me. But Mary had a son that died when he was 14. And I'd give Mary from the meetings, give her a ride to the meeting, whatever Mary wanted. Mary passed away about 10 years ago. And she had over 50 years. And I went to Denny's one night. One thing we used to do is we used to go to meetings. After the meetings, we would go out to eat with each other. Didn't matter who you were. If you were in this clique or that clique, back then there wasn't that many cliques. You know, you just went to meetings. And like I've been sober a long time, I don't know what's happened. There's a big influx of treatment stuff going on. I guess when you used to detox in a room with somebody, then I guess you got more close to those people than you do now. But we would go out to eat and stuff, and I got kind of close to a lot of people. Even though they didn't really care for me being there, they didn't tell me I had to leave. And that's the first thing I noticed about AA. I'd walk into the room and look around and see anybody to see if there was anybody looking at me. And there would be always a few bulldogs in the room, and I was one of them, and we'd nod at each other. And they'd nod back. And that basically was like, you know, peeking on the corner here. You know, you stay in that part of the room, and you stay in that part of the room, and I'll stay right here, we'll be fine. But no time have I ever been to an AA meeting where I walked in and somebody ran out. They got up and moved now, but they didn't leave the meeting because I came in. And I went to Denny's one night with some people, and there was a drunk sitting at the damn table that used to work for me when I was a superintendent. His name is Woody. And Woody was sober. I had a few years on him. And he came over and invited me over to the table and introduced me to everybody. He was from Napa. Didn't know Napa existed. I knew Biscayne existed. I knew Rebus existed. And Bronner's. But that was it. And so he invited me over here to Napa. And I started coming to meetings over here at Friday Night Frights. And that became my home group for the next 14 years. That and Night Owls. So Night Owls disbanded. I was a member of Biscayne and a member of Napa. And back then they were real judgmental about who they let in here. The only reason I got to be a member of NABA is because Reno was downstairs and he vouched for my sobriety and my character from Biscayne Room. Or those old men downstairs weren't going to let me become a member. And And one of those guys pissed me off once. His name was Jimmy V. Trying to close my hippie meeting down. Because they were doing all this stuff, and I said, no, they're not. So I went to the office and talked to Jan about some sort of rules around here. And she said, yeah, we got rules, and we got bylaws. And I said, well, give me out. Can I have a copy? He goes, yeah, you can have a copy. See, anybody can get them. I said, okay. So I read those rules and bylaws, and I memorized those bylaws. And I preached those bylaws back to Jimmy V. And he left me and that group alone. And, you know, I've got a lot of stories, but basically, I got into service at Biscayne, I got the service over here, because it was really easy, because nobody else would do anything. And like, a lot of people talk about it. You know, a lot of bleeding deacons out there, but nobody was taking any action. And I was tired of that stuff over at Biscayne, because over at Biscayne, they put me to work, washing coffee cups and ashtrays. And them coffee cups that have lipstick on them. And the stuff that did not want to come off the coffee cup. And after about 3 months, they brought some other new guy in there to wash those coffee cups and ashtrays. And they said, whoa, what's this guy doing in here? He goes, he's going to wash some coffee cups and ashtrays. I said, oh, no, those are my coffee cups and ashtrays to wash. I said, he's going to mop the floor. It's like, what was I thinking? You know. But that's how things rotated over there. An old guy named Bobby Raynard was the caretaker of Biscayne back then. He's passed too. And they told me a long time ago, speaking of that, that if you're going to stay sober a while, get a black suit. You're going to a lot of funerals. And I have. I think the most I've gone to is 7 in 1 year. And they came over here and got involved in the Friday night frights. And before long, I got involved. Somebody wanted me to run for the board of directors over here. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, my big thing in life was the Friday Night Frights that made me their treasurer. Like, oh my God, they trusted me with the money. And so I ran, and I didn't make it. And I pissed the old man off then, too, because I got one more vote than he did. His name was Fred Cameron. He was so damn mad, he couldn't see straight. But, make a real long story short. I've been on the board of directors in Abbott for 10 years. 10 different years, not all in a row. I've been a GSR for over 13 years. I've been treasurer, secretary, you name it, I've done it. I've been every position on the board at least once. Some of them 3 times. One of them 9 times. The only reason I'm not going on 10 times is because I finally got some relief from my friend over here. I was the AA liaison on the board of directors for 9 different times. And, you know, it's nice to be able to sit back and not do that. You know, less phone calls. And at one time I had 3 different sponsors. One for my sobriety, one for my service work, and one for my emotions. And because, you know, I have an instant rage. And through this program and through the works of this program and the people in it, the steps in it, and the higher power in it, you know, I've come to deal with that a lot better, where I can just be calm. I can just breathe, as Steve would say. Steve would tell me, just breathe, just breathe. Because, you know, flash anger and is one thing, getting mad all the time is one thing, but when you just go from instant rage, it's a whole other psychological problem. And it's been suggested that I go see a psychologist about some things. And it's been suggested that I see other self-help groups about some things. But, you know, I don't always take my suggestions immediately. It may take 10 years or so. In my first 10 years, my sponsors were my adversaries. They were not my friends. They were not somebody I wanted to talk to. Everything I said, they were in disagreement with. And, you know, I had to look at me about that. Look at me. And just like my father, damn, they weren't right. 99% of the time, they were right. No matter how differently I tried to do something, I'm going to do it different than you. It would come out the same result. So I've learned to take suggestions or at least look at that and have an open mind about things. And one time I was serving 13 different service positions at one time. And I was about to go insane. And I told Steve in the office in there, I said, I'm quitting. I'm quitting everything. I can't do this anymore. And he goes, no, you're not quitting. You will go insane if you were to quit everything at once. Just drop everything, but just a couple. So I did. And life got better because, you know, you can't do everything and do everything well. You can do one or two things well and do a couple other things on the side not so well. But, you know, don't try doing 10 or 13 at one time. I lost my hair. Yeah. You know, I didn't have a head full of hair when I came in here. But, you know, my service work and my friends and my sponsors and the people in these rooms being able to watch people. Like I watch a lot of people. I don't maybe talk to you much, but I watch you. And I see what you're doing and what you're not doing and what you say. And I probably got 5 friends in AA that I can call when something goes wrong, and they'll be there without a question. Without a question. There's few of them in this room. And to me, before, that was insane thinking. I mean, if I paid somebody, or if I had, you know, 100 caps or something, they'd come do something for me. But they would not just drop everything and go do something, come to my aid for some reason. And today I've got at least 5 of those. And I've been 1, 2, 3, 4. I've been married 4 times in sobriety, engaged once, and divorced a couple of times. If you want to know how that works, we'll talk later. But and I came in here married, so. You know, I looked at my story the past couple of days since, you know, I've got locked into this thing with my name on the board. And there's a lot of different ways I could have told my story, but, you know, after a while, after you stay sober long enough, there's just too much to tell. There's too many situations, different situations that may come up that I can help you with that, or I know somebody that can at least share it with you. You know, the helping part's up to you. But the more I thought about it, the more I thought about it, it's like, damn, it'd be a damn, I have to write some memoir or something, you know. The people I've known, the people that are gone, the people I've seen, the people I don't know in this room, the people I don't know that come to meetings at this address. And I swear, I can be here at 4 times a week and 3 days a week, somebody will say, hey, Frank. And it's somebody I've never seen before in my life. Don't have a clue as who they are. But they know my name. So, I'm not sure if I'm doing something right. But at least I'm going to be somebody they can come to and ask a question. Give them a book. You know, give them somebody's phone number. You know, I can tell you, you know, I hated God when I came in here. I hated God. My son had just been taken from me. And you guys are all about God. I made that damn doorway over to Biscayne going into the living sober room, the doorknob. I made it because you said you can make it, you know, your higher power anything you want it to be. It could be a doorknob. I made that doorknob my higher power. And that worked good for about 2 weeks. And that just wasn't enough, so I made the whole door my higher power for a long time. Because, you know, I was not in good stead with God. You know, He had hurt me in a way that I could not retaliate against. I had nobody I could just go kill or hurt. And it took me a long time to have an acceptance of a higher power out of my understanding. And, you know, it takes what it takes. As long as you keep coming back, and you don't get run off for some reason, or get barred from this place, then just keep coming back to a different place, different meetings. They're all over the place now. There's over 700 a week here. Not in this building, but in Atlanta. There's always some place to come, people to call. You can find somebody. Unless you choose otherwise. And until now, I've chosen to stay here. Even though there have been a few in this building try to run me off. But I'm still here. You just watch me and see how I act and let me know what if I'm screwing up something. I mean, there's only a couple of people in this room I would listen to, but they saw me screwing up. But that's all I have for you. That's all, you know. I hope there's not like a bunch of questions afterwards. But thanks for letting me share with you. That was great, Frank. I bet a few of us would make a deal with you. If you stick around, we'll keep coming back.
On that broad highway.